the good meals, the good food that's been given to poor children in this nation, the improved nutrition in their homes through our training programs, certainly far from a failure. It was Head Start that for the first time raised the important principle of parent involvement. What we must learn in this nation is that experts alone will never have maximal impact on children. It's families that raise children, essentially. It's parents. And this concept, this awareness, was pioneered by the Head Start effort. The advocacy role of Head Start often goes unrewarded, unheralded. Wherever there's a Head Start center, there's a group that care about children. We did a report in Washington, unnoted by the press, the Kirshner Report, in which we discovered that in 58 cities where there was a Head Start center, we could identify 1,500 identifiable changes in the health and education programs in those cities. Head Start has put many people who are themselves ghetto individuals, poor people, into training. We now have over 10,000, primarily women, who are themselves poor, who as a result of Head Start have gotten college training in child care and who are now taking their places in a very badly needed cadre of workers, namely those who care for young children. Well, nevertheless, with all of these obvious accomplishments, to say nothing of the repeated finding that at the end of Head Start, the children in Head Start are better on every identifiable dimension than children not in Head Start, we continue to hear that that Head Start is a failure. Interestingly enough, Head Start has currently come under attack by the hereditarians. Jensen, in his monograph of about 3 years ago now, does not only give us a questionable analysis of the heritability issue on man and in the difference between the races in respect to some basic intellectual factor, but he introduces the entire discussion with the statement, compensatory education has failed. Really? How so? What we have, and I will allude to this later in my talk, is a basic error of equating our ability of changing the IQ with our ability to intervene in the lives of children in such a way as to make them generally more competent and happier human beings. A major theme of my talk to you here today will be that IQ is not the only important aspect of a child's functioning and a child's development, and that we must rediscover the whole child. IQ does not, in the last analysis, determine what happens to an individual. But such factors as his motivation, his personality, his values, his attitudes can be as critical, if not more critical, than his cognitive wherewithal, a point of view that has seems to have escaped the those interested in the hereditary component in intelligence. I think, in supporting Jensen's point of view, makes the same error in his book entitled The IQ Argument, in which at least Jensen was kind enough not to pick on Head Start, but I think, in his introduction, specifically names Head Start as the failure on the American scene. Now, I do believe that the growing acceptance of a generally negative view in Washington about children's programs can be traced back to one point of view and an emphasis which permeated our intervention efforts in the 60s, and a point of view which by its very nature had to give rise to a sense of disappointment and disillusionment. I am referring here to the unbridled environmentalistic position with its essentially cognitive emphasis that convinced decision makers that even an 8-week program would have lasting impact on the intellectual functioning of the child. Indeed, the entire intervention strategy of the 60s appears to have been based on questionable formulations, and we should certainly not allow these formulations to defeat us in the 70s. Now, again, I also do not come before you as a reincarnation of Arnold Gazelle. I agree with Burton Blatt that the mind is plastic. I do agree that there is much that we can do on the environmental front to make the lives of children better. But what Burton Blatt appreciates, and which many thinkers in the 60s and current thinkers in the 70s do not appreciate, is the amount of effort that has to be expended. The dedication required, the commitment and effort and energy and money to meaningfully impact the life of a child. Instead, in the 60s, we got some cliches, an overly environmentalistic viewpoint from the sense of differences among children. And this gave rise to tokenism in our efforts. There was also some other mistakes in these assumptions of the 60s which we should not allow to continue in the 70s. One was the basic formulation that poor children, simply because they were poor, experienced depriving environments, which gave rise to cognitive deficits, which in turn could be corrected by enriching experiences. That was the philosophy that underlay our early efforts. A poor child experiences something bad, and that results in a cognitive deficit, and we could fix it if we could just get the right curriculum. I'm not convinced that we had the theoretical base in the 60s, the evidence, to support that particular formulation. For instance, what is the deprivation that poor children experience? Well, the theorists were hard-pressed to say. Certainly not every poor child has a cognitive deficit. There are many of you in this audience, I'm sure, who have yourself risen out of poverty because of your good intellects. What could it possibly be? And we didn't know, and we didn't try very vigorously to find out. There was some loose analogizing in our theories about Hebb's dogs, I remember. There was a series of experiments done at McGill with Hebb and Thompson and other workers. And what they discovered was that if you had some dogs and you raise these dogs in darkness, and then you put these dogs on a learning maze, they do not perform as well in this learning task as dogs who had been reared in the light. And people said, aha, that must be what deprivation is all about. There's some kind of sensory deprivation from which our poor children suffer. And that became the rationale for the sensory enrichment that became the hallmark of our intervention efforts. In fact, I think it was a study in New York where they tried to document this sensory deprivation. So they sent investigators into the ghetto apartments in New York City and discovered something not terribly surprising, that you walk into an apartment there and there are four or five children who are in interaction with one another, the television set is going, the windows open and street noises are coming in, neighbors are dropping in all through the day. And they looked at this and they said, my Lord, where's the sensory deprivation? And it didn't slow them down one whit. They went back to their laboratory and said, aha, now we have it. Too much sensory input. Well, as a theorist, I have no problem with the concept of optimal sensory input for a developing child, and we do have theoretical formulations about a match between a child's schema in the Piagetian sense and what should be coming into him and so forth and so on. But there hasn't been any kind of careful mapping of that sort. There's that much of our thinking simply is still based on this very loose analogizing without the kinds of evidence that is required for building programs on a sound scientific formulation. Indeed, I am not convinced that the basic problems of poor children is their cognitive deficits, just as I have long been convinced that a basic problem of our retarded children does not lie so much with their low intellect as much as with other factors. Only recently, in respect to poor children, has a group of investigators come forward who have argued that the cognitive deficits are actually performance deficits and have more to do with the way we test children and their attitudes and motives and the nature of the situational press on children than it has to do with the nature of the child's cognitive functioning. I would refer you especially to the interesting work of LaBeouf, who works with black, deprived, I'll put deprived in quotes, children, from the ghetto in New York. And he has these wonderful tapes. And by the way, there's an Atlantic Monthly article on this in which these tapes are reported. And these tapes are really indicates exactly what I'm talking about. The teacher asks the child some question, which, of course, the child from his milieu thinks is innate and on its face. And the child goes, and you get like no language. And it's very easy on the basis of that to think of that output as an inexorable reflection of the child's cognition. Well, it is not. Because you take these same children and you meet with them in their homes and you get down on the floor with them with a sack of potato chips and ask them the same kinds of questions and you get a rich display of language. There's no cognitive deficit. There's simply a barrier to interacting in the school situation, which strikes me as more of a problem of the deficits of the American school than it is a deficit of black young children. Now, I could also point out other people who have been coming forward to say, let's examine these shortcomings again. Let's not immediately buy this kind of environmentalistic-cognitive package that we've heard for so many years. A recent paper in The American Psychologist by Colin Bruner makes much the same point that I'm making to you here this morning. But again, there has been, as I say, an era in which we have promised much too much, promised much too glibly. It was, as I say, an unbridled environmentalism that gave rise to a undue optimism, which by its very nature had to turn off the American people and result in what we are now seeing, I'm afraid, which is an overstated pessimism about what we can do with young children. Now, I don't have to remind you too much, I hope, about the period that we have just lived through, a period stretching from about 10 years ago to the present, in which we have been literally deluged with curricula, programs, and gadgetry, which, if only applied to a child in his early years, guarantees normal and or superior intelligence. It was as though the biological law of human variability had been repealed. We were going to somehow or other find techniques that we could use so that all of our children in every classroom would test above the mean. And we got it from all sides. Deutsch's interesting project in the early 60s, when it was finally reported in the press, the headline was, "Program increases the IQ a point a month." Well, you know, many of us would have liked to send our children down for 30 or 40 months' worth. We saw a distinguished scholar writing for that most sacrosanct of all scientific journals, the Reader's Digest, in which there was a banner headline, that little piece of paper that they put on the front, "Raise your child's IQ by 20 points." We saw books, "Give your child a superior mind." We saw other books, "Teach your child to read at 2. I don't know what in the world a child would want to be reading at 2 for anyway. There's so many more interesting and important things for the child to be doing at that particular time in his life. But there was this very optimistic, boy, just give us your child and we'll give you a book or a gadget or something or other, and you know, the next stop is definitely Harvard. I think that has abated somewhat, partially because of the hereditary counterattack, which is just as wrong in its emphasis as the environmentalistic, this naive environmentalistic position is in its. But we still get leading figures writing in our scientific journals, reporting to us infant studies in which IQs are raised in one study 48 points and another study over 75 points. What we really have in these studies, which do so much to delude decision makers and the layman, is simply that there are certain benchmarks early in life. So obviously, if you're looking at a three, if you can get a six-month-old to do something that a three-month-old would normally do, you've increased his IQ 100 points. But what does it really mean? Very little if you remember that the relationship between these benchmark measures and later intelligence is zero. Another questionable formulation was around the issue of whether the first few years of life represented some magic period during which a child could be inoculated against any and all negative experiences following the first few years. Now, again, I'm not here before you to say, gee, the first few years are unimportant. What I'm here before you to tell you is that all the years are important, and there probably has been too much of an emphasis on the first few years alone. Why? Well, it's interesting how just one little good clang saying will move the nation. You know, we're quite ready to move with not a firm enough scientific base at the cost of billions of dollars into universal preschool education in this nation, primarily because one investigator came forward with a statement which every congressman quotes to me at every hearing that I have attended in the last 2 years, namely, that half of the children's learning is over by the age of four. Everybody believes this now. What does a statement like that really mean? Those of us who have studied Piaget certainly can't accept it. We appreciate the stages of development. We understand that a child is learning, at least even cognitively, up through the 16th year of life, each stage being as important as every other stage. Further, it's essentially a meaningless statement. So let's ask the next question. What is the evidence? The evidence is as follows. IQ tests that you give to a population of children can be correlated with each other to say how much is your IQ at a certain age related to your IQ at a later age. And we discover, as I pointed out before, if I get a developmental quotient on a child aged 6 months and correlate that with his IQ at 12 or 14 when it's at an asymptote or 16, that correlation is zero. Now, if I do those tests, if I look at the correlation, the relationship between IQ scores at age 2 and 16, that correlation jumps up to 50. But since we're all statisticians enough to know that you have to square the correlation to see what its real worth is, we know that that will predict 25% of the intelligence score later in life. Now, at the age of 4, that correlation jumps up to about 70. Now, if you square that correlation, you've got 49. And if you round off the 49, you've got 50. And then we come out with a statement that since the correlation between the IQ scores at 4 and 16 are 70, which picks up 50% of the relationship, the covariance, as we say, that somehow means that half the learning is over by the age of 4. If the nonsense is not already apparent to you, let me give you an analogy. If I know the midpoint of the two parents' IQs, if I tested two parents and simply got the mean of their IQs, I also know through empirical investigation that that IQ, that score, is also related, correlated, 0.70, roughly, with the child's later intelligence. So by the kind of thinking that this nation has been sold, I can make the argument that half of the child's learning is over before he's born. Well, a lot of compensatory programs didn't. I mean, all this plasticity and all the greatness that we were going to do, well, we didn't pull it off. There were too many investigations that showed that, gee, after you've done all you could for a child in Head Start Center, he still had some problems. Now, why that should surprise anybody, I'm not so sure. But again, we'd sold this notion of some kind of magic period in there at about 4 or 5, give him that Head Start shot, and he'd be home free. That's not the nature of development. Now, when it didn't work, of course, what the country did was not really bite the bullet and say, gee, it's tough to change a child, and this nation must make a meaningful commitment to children if they wish them to prosper and develop. Instead, we kept looking for magic periods, and of course, the magic period we found in recent years was infancy. I'm sure many of you remember the Life magazine cover of a couple years ago where we had that delightful little infant looking up and into this visual display, and inside our colleagues at MIT and Harvard presented their case about the importance of infant stimulation. We had the work of Bud White, who did indeed demonstrate that if you would put these visual displays over the cribs of infants, certain developmental benchmarks, again unrelated to later intelligence, were indeed accelerated. And so there was, before long, a real feeling in the nation that if we could just get a mobile over every infant's crib, we'd be home free. Well, if we are going to be advocates for children, part of advocacy is education. The magic period approach leads to token programs. We've learned that already. Unfortunately, we as Americans are an impatient people, too often seeking simple solutions to complex problems. But I will tell you, on the basis of directing programs, as well as on the basis of my own scholarly investigation of the theories of human development, that there are no magic periods, for the simple reason that every year in the life of a developing child is a magic period. I think that the president's commitment from the area to a time span from birth to five was a step in the right direction. That is, we at least have a block of time that the nation is concerned about. But I will predict to you this morning that if we do everything we possibly can for a child between birth and five, the child will be somewhat better off. But for all practical intents and purposes, we might as well have stayed in bed, because a child continues to develop. What we have to begin teaching, and some of us learning, is that the nature of development contains a very basic principle, which is the principle of continuity, stage built upon stage, personality factors in youth affecting the next aspect of attitude formation and value formation, a continuity in life in which you can't desert a child before that child essentially, becomes the kind of autonomous individual that we find in maturity. We have to support the development of children in the first 5 years of life, and the next five, and the next five after that. Indeed, I think one of the important areas that we seem to often forget is the first 9 months of a child's life, so that any meaningful program for children in the 70s would very definitely have to take into consideration that point of time between conception and birth, because just the nature of the developing embryo and fetus during this period, the importance of the nutrition of the pregnant mother, the importance of good health care, is itself an important factor, so that when we begin thinking of programs for children in the 70s, let's think of dovetailed efforts in which we combine a concern for children approximately from the point of conception to 15 or 16 years of age. Now, another problem of the 60s, which I think can be traced to the environmental mystique, which we should not allow to hamper us in the 70s, is the belief that it was the poor and or the black that was deprived of culture, and as a result, it was the poor only that could profit from early childhood programs. As a result of this kind of thinking, it's the poor that are deprived and the poor that have cognitive deficits, and therefore we should have programs for the poor. It was this kind of thinking that gave rise to programs mounted in which poor children were forever separated from their more affluent peers. I was delighted to hear this morning, here in this room, the need for children of all types to be in interaction with one another, and the value to children in having programs of that kind. Yet, for children much more numerous than just the handicapped, and I'm speaking here of the poor, we blithely continue to set up programs in which they are segregated from children of differing socioeconomic classes. This should not be the case in the 70s. When we mount programs in the future, they should be available to the poor for free. They should be available to working class individuals on the payment of small fees. And they should be available to the middle class on payment of fees that they could afford to pay. But we have to find some way of mounting programs for all children, not just programs like Head Start for poor children. I think there are three basic reasons why programs in the future should partake of this heterogeneous grouping. The first I have learned the hard way. It's a pragmatic political reason. There is no outcry for children in this nation for, I think, the reason that when we mount programs, we simply don't get a broad enough constituency. Head Start is a perfect example. Many working class people don't have the attitude that Head Start has failed. Their antipathy and sometimes anger is because their children can't participate. Even the word annoys them. Head Start, what does that mean? That means to a working class family that some child is getting a head start over their child at their expense. So what I'm saying is that if we're ever going to have programs that are politically viable, that have a broad base of support in our citizenry, they cannot be limited to the poor alone. As Senator Birchbeide has pointed out on the floor of the Senate, these programs simply never grow, they never develop, for the very simple reason that poor people alone, separated from the more affluent, simply have no political clout. Now, there are two other reasons why we should have these types of integrated programs, and again, I feel somewhat foolish telling the audience at Syracuse these other reasons, but let me briefly touch upon them. First is the developmental factor. There is now a growing body of evidence that modeling among children is very important, that children learn best when they have a wide variety of models. So that is important from the developmental viewpoint of the child to see that children are in interaction with one another across a wide array of dimensions, social class, race, anything that we can do to increase the range of models for our nation's children, so much the better from a developmental viewpoint. And again, I am not talking about one-way modeling. I am convinced, and I have got some evidence that supports my conviction, that middle-class children can learn a great deal from children who are not as affluent, because the evidence now shows greater independence in poorer children, greater creativity, so that there is much to be learned by children from children of every walk of life. There's another reason why I think the programs of the 70s should do all that they can to incorporate children across wide ranges of class and race, cultural background. This is a social psychological reason. I have been troubled in recent years by the fractionation in our society, by the polarization, by the hostility. One can't help but feel that the very fabric of our society is coming undone. The hatred, the hostility. I am enough of a social psychologist to know that if we separate people into enclaves, what you get is some in-group solidarity, but almost always at a cost of out-group hostility. The values of this nation mean a great deal to me, and certainly one of those values is that we do not take young children, age 3, 4, and 5, and separate them along social class lines. How will these children ever grow up to be understanding or tolerant of individuals unlike themselves if even in childhood we give them the message, you are different and you go here, you are something else and you go there? I'm also of the belief that our Head Start efforts of the future, our child care efforts of the future, must appreciate the myriad of needs faced by children and their families, and certainly cease treating poor children as a homogeneous group of cognitively deficient individuals who could be rescued en masse if we could just find the panacea buried in some yet undiscovered universal curriculum. It's time to break out of the rigidity that characterizes so much of even the Head Start effort in this nation. Is every poor child like every other poor child? Of course not. You find the same range of intelligence among the poor as you do among the rich. They're different. And this nation must begin respecting human differences. The idea of a rich society is not a society in which every child and every adult is like each other, but a society in which the differences among children are recognized, appreciated. We love children because of what they are, not because of what their IQ scores tell us they are. So the idea that what we should be doing with poor children is swooping them up and giving them our treatment in Head Start centers for 5 half-days a week and that will solve their problems simply is not commensurate with the variation that I see among poor children. And we should begin thinking not of a Head Start program that is a rigid program, but rather become more innovative and more realistic and say, gee, let's make the Head Start programs into Head Start centers, which each center sitting in a community dedicated to the service of families in that community and sensitive to all of the needs and the variations in needs of children in that community. So that I see the Head Start centers of the 70s being concerned with the care of pregnant mothers. They should have an outreach program in which it is their responsibility to find out which mother is pregnant and to see that that mother gets the kind of care that she needs. We should see these programs in the future broadening their horizons in terms of what works, moving more in the direction of Home Start programs, working directly with mothers and helping mothers raise their own children rather than always taking the child from the home and putting the child into a center. We must see these centers coming to grips with the problem of daycare for working mothers. We should see these centers using the summer months not for a tokenistic 6 or 8 week program that does little more than guarantee the salaries of the teachers, but rather a meaningful, circumscribed program of health in which we swoop up the children in that neighborhood and see that they are all inoculated, in which we use these summer months for lead paint screening, in which we do sickle cell anemia screening in neighborhoods of black children. We should begin appreciating the variations among poor children and not treating them as some stereotyped homogeneous group. Why can't we have 2 or 3 day programs for the younger child or the child who comes from a better organized home? Why doesn't the Head Start of the future be more concerned about the handicapped child, which in large part has been totally ignored in this most important program? For these children, we would want even more intensive programs in which we got children younger than the 4 or 5 that we now work with, age 4 or 5. I think that it is also imperative that in the future that we rediscover the whole child and begin to appreciate that the primary goal of child care programs is not higher IQs or accelerated cognitive development, but rather the improved general functioning of the child. Indeed, we must begin to question whether the real problem of even poor children is a problem of intellect. Cognition and or intelligence does not equal social competence, which is often, I think social competence is often much more influenced by values, motives, and attitudes. It is my conviction that a large part of the performance deficit of poor children is due to motivational factors rather than to intellectual factors. This became clear to me as long ago as 1965, when sitting in the White House in Washington, Mrs. Johnson, who was the honorary chairman of our committee, kicked off Head Start. And in a speech, she said something which which concerned me greatly. It was I don't remember which of our intellects to blame this on, but there was a little statement going around in the mid-60s about children who showed up at school who did not even know their own names. And, of course, it was this environmentalistic cognitive deficit thinking. The notion was that, gee, children have such depriving environments that they develop a cognitive system between their ears which does not allow them, by the age of 6, to store and retrieve their own names. Now, again, if one takes treats that question as a single-item intelligence test, one can immediately compute what the IQs of these children would have to be below. I mean, it's a test that looks like this. What's your name? Well, if a child says, I don't know, he obviously gets a zero. But when do we expect a child to know his own name and give it to you upon request? Some children do it at 2, 2.5, most children can do it. If a child can't do this for you by the age of 3, you begin having some very serious concerns about the child. Which would mean that if this characterized poor children, and they come to school at 6, and here's something they should have at 3, that means their IQs would have to be below 50. Well, is this what characterizes poor children in this nation? No, not at all. Well, we have to reanalyze that kind of situation. What are you really dealing with? Well, I don't think you're dealing with a cognitive deficit. Child shows up in the classroom. Usually he shows up on the first day of school. The teacher is loaded down with 400 forms that the principal insists that she fill out. She rushes about the room getting the child's name. She comes up to this child who's been in this organized school for all of 20 minutes and comes sweeping down usually because she has her problems and says, what's your name? Well, I think that a whole process is put into place in that situation. I think the child knows his name perfectly well, but he's got all kinds of attitudes and values. He's learned certain things as a result of his milieu. And I think what runs through his mind is, gee, should I tell her? Well, she looks okay. I think I'll tell her. But wait, maybe it'll stop the welfare check. Well, what do you learn in the ghettos of this country when faced with a situation like that? You keep your mouth shut. You never get in any trouble saying, I don't know. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is not just an anecdote, because it has vast implications for what you do with these children. If you really believe the child doesn't know his name, you do what we saw in Head Start so commonly. You get a mirror, and the child has to look in the mirror every day, and then one by one you add the letters of his name, and he then has to put the image together with the letters, and you go through this cognitive ritual, and usually by the end of the Head Start, you say, well, we've taught him his name. We've really improved his cognitive system. But there wasn't anything wrong with that system to begin with. The problem was in his trust of strangers. Now, this point became clear to me when we decided to do a little experiment in New Haven, in which I asked the Head Start teachers to be on their guard about children who showed up not knowing their own name. Well, in a program of almost 300 children, we only found 13. But I told the teachers to do a fairly simple thing. I have certain reservations about Professor Skinner and his formulations, but I'm not above using a little operant engineering when it suits my purposes. I told the teachers to say to the child who didn't know their own name, I said, say to them, gee, it must be scary to have someone you don't know ask you your name, and you're probably wanting to know why I need to know it. Well, you see, a little later this morning, we're going to have juice and cookies, and if I don't know your name, I might not be able to call you, and you'll miss your juice and cookies. At which point, 12 of the 13 children immediately knew their own names. The 13th child is an interesting case in point. I had given up. I'd made my point. The teacher kept working away with this child, reported to me that the child stood in the corner and wouldn't participate and was really pretty much out of it. And, you know, with a program of 300 children, there could well be one child with an IQ below 50 or an autistic child. But the teacher kept working away with this girl, and one day an older girl from the neighborhood came to pick up our little heroine, and the teacher was, bless her, was still working away and said, "Well, you know, this little girl doesn't know her name, but I bet you know her name." Whereupon the little girl grabbed the older girl and shouted, "Don't tell her!" Well, let me just conclude by saying that I think that much of our training of, or much of our work with the poor and with the handicapped, has got to be sensitive to all of the aspects of the child that makes a whole person. And that what you will discover, and I'm sure have discovered at Syracuse, is what we've discovered in New Haven, that oftentimes the problems of these children have little to do with their intellect and much to do with their self-image, how they feel about themselves, how they feel about others, their sense of being respected, their sense of is it safe to give affection to other human beings, their sense of trust, their sense of autonomy, whether they have an aspiration level that says to them, "I can achieve." Well, again, let me conclude my talk to you this morning by saying that the discovery of whole children only takes place by people, by adults, who are themselves whole, who themselves have values that are worthwhile. I have no question, knowing the people here at Syracuse, that the whole child will not be lost here, because you do indeed have leadership and thinkers who are themselves characterized by a value system in which the fullness and wholeness of a child and his development is certainly appreciated. I'm honored to be here and join with you in the dedication. I would like to add my thanks to the Gebbe Foundation for making the building for Syracuse possible, because there's every indication that what happens at Syracuse, though very important to you and your community, has a national impact as well. Because I see here, under Bert Blatt's leadership and the leadership of the chancellor and the dean and others, models being developed, concerns being expressed that could well be a model for the nation that will make child care in the 70s better than it has been in the 60s. Thank you.
Overwhelmed by the erudition, by the scholarship, by the great encouragement Dr. Ziegler has given to us this morning. It's just been marvelous. And on behalf of everyone, I think the applause tells you how much we appreciate your remarks. This is the first part of today's activities. Immediately following, everyone here is invited to our building, the Gebbe Clinic, the Hoople Building. There will be tours, refreshments, an audiovisual presentation. We invite you immediately at your leisure. If you have cars parked on the campus, I'm suggesting that you don't move them unless the weather has changed remarkably with some rain or snow or something else. We suggest you leave the cars where you have them and take a leisurely walk to the building, which is on the corner of South Krause and Marshall. For those who will move cars for one reason or another, I can inform you that behind the School of Social Work on South Krause, there's a parking lot that's relatively empty. We also have a parking lot contiguous to our own building, and if you can find parking there or around behind Huntington Hall, please do. Watch out for parking tickets. Don't park in illegal places, because you will get a ticket. So, again, I want to thank everyone here, but especially I'd like to mention two additional people who put this entire program together. Bill English, who represents a very devoted committee of many people who deserve to be mentioned, but I won't in the interest of time. Bill English is professor of rehabilitation counseling in our division. And Ann Dobie, who works so valiantly and so well with Neil Rossman and his entire office, who has done absolutely astonishing and remarkable work for us here. We want to thank all of you, all of the participants, the Chancellor, Dean McComb, Mr. Hamilton, Dean Crothwell, Dr. Ziegler, everyone here, all the wives who trudged along, all of the husbands who trudged along, everyone else, thank you very much for coming. We'll see you in a few minutes.